Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Dunaway, here with my co-host Dean Welty, and today we are going to travel back in time and revisit one of our past programs. It's a program that's near and dear to my heart because it deals with the Convention of States Project, an effort I've been working on for the past few years now, and one that I believe offers Americans the last, best hope to restore constitutional governance in our nation. With state legislatures across the country going back into session this month, I think it's time for a little refresher course on this. So, Dean, are you ready to time travel?
Yes, Rita, I am ready. Let's go.
All right, let's listen.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty, along with Rita Dunaway, and today we'll be talking about something that has been a recurring concern in several of our programs: federal government overreach and unconstitutional abuse of its authority and power. As an example, in an earlier program, we referred to the Obama administration's executive order for schools across the nation to allow students to use a bathroom other than the one for their birth gender. This was an act of federal bullying, because it did so without congressional authorization or approval and thus exceeded its constitutional authority. And it raises an important question. Who gave the president the power to write laws, and who put him in charge of our nation's schools? So, today we'll take a close look at the Constitution, review how we have strayed from it, and discuss one specific remedy found in Article 5 of that same Constitution. Rita, I know you're an expert on this. I know you're on the edge of your chair just waiting to educate us and inform us and mobilize us on where we go with this effort to rein in a runaway federal government.
Indeed I am, Dean. I can't wait to get started this morning.
All right.
But to sort of set the stage for us, I think it's important, before we launch into this, to really understand just how big the problem is. And I know of no one better than Mark Levin. You may know of Mark Levin. He's a popular talk radio show host, and whatever you may think of his style or his programs, he is a brilliant man. He's a former Ronald Reagan appointee and just a brilliant, brilliant man, and he knows his Constitution. He's written several books.
Yes, but he has. I've read all of them, I think.
My favorite of his books is The Liberty Amendments, which I recommend to the audience just in general, and it does really go into detail about the Article 5 solution we're going to discuss later. But the part I want to share as we get started is just where he describes the problem. And it's a little bit of a longer quote, but it just describes it so well. So here goes. This is from Mark Levin's The Liberty Amendments. What was to be a relatively innocuous federal government, operating from a defined enumeration of specific grants of power, has become an ever-present and unaccountable force. It is the nation's largest creditor, debtor, lender, employer, consumer, contractor, grantor, property owner, tenant, insurer, healthcare provider, and pension guarantor. Moreover, with aggrandized police powers, what it does not control directly, it bans or mandates by regulation. For example, the federal government regulates most things in your bathroom, laundry room, and kitchen, as well as the mortgage you hold on your house. It designs your automobile and dictates the kind of fuel it uses. It regulates your baby's toys, crib, and stroller, plans your children's school curriculum and lunch menu, and administers their student loans in college. At your place of employment, the federal government oversees everything from the racial, gender, and age diversity of the workforce to the hours, wages, and benefits paid. Indeed, the question is not what the federal government regulates, but what it does not. And it makes you wonder, How can a people incapable of selecting their own light bulbs and toilets possess enough competence to vote for their own rulers and fill out complicated tax returns? And that's the end of the section that I wanted to read. But, Dean, does that describe something that sounds like a problem to you?
I'm depressed already. It really goes back then to what we're talking about, the importance of the Constitution and how the Constitution was really designed to limit the power of the federal government. And that's what we're going to be talking about, is what has happened to that respect and the authority granted by the Constitution to limiting the powers of our federal government. Really brings us back to a couple of quotations from our founding fathers about the role of the Constitution in this. Thomas Jefferson, for example, said, "In questions of power, then, let no more be said of confidence in man, but bind him down from mischief by the chains of the Constitution."
I love that quote.
And the second one by John Adams, very similar, but it really comes back to the people. "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." So it really brings us back to a culture, faith and culture, and how we bring these things into balance. Mm-hmm. I'll just turn it over to you with this comment. "If there is no one to stop the growing intrusion of government in our lives that you just described, it begins to look more and more like tyranny."
Exactly.
"Where power is concentrated in the hands of one person or only a few people." Yes. And that seems to be where we're trending today, almost like going back to King George, where we were being oppressed by a despotic government.
Yeah. You know, to paraphrase a great Ronald Reagan quote that I don't have in front of me, he said something like, "The centralization of power has always been the enemy of liberty." And so when I read that passage from Levin's book and reflect on how big and powerful the federal government has become, I start to wonder, how is it that everyone is not just alarmed and in outrage over this? And you know, I can understand why in some countries, when they think about their government having all those kinds of powers, it's not alarming. But the reason it should be alarming to every single American is because it is diametrically opposed to the founders' vision for America. The hallmark of the American federal system is a national government or federal government with few limited specifically enumerated powers, and then state governments with many and broad powers.
Well, Rita, going back to your question, why are we allowing this to happen? It is, in fact, a creeping socialism in our culture.
Yes.
And in our economy, where we are getting free things. Look what's happening in Venezuela. It doesn't work, but we keep getting free things. We get politicians who keep promising more free things, and we put them into office, and we become dependent on our government for all the things that you just described. It is a sad comment, but let's go back now to the Constitution and the original intention.
Yes.
Our founders were so concerned about this growing power in government that they insisted on putting an amendment in the Constitution that addressed specifically this problem. It's the 10th Amendment, and it reinforces the concerns that we share now today. And I'll just quote from it because it is so powerful. "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people." And really, Rita, that raises a question. That's why the founders designed a government with a separation of powers, checks and balances, to avoid giving too much power to one person or a group of persons, or to concentrating the power in Washington rather than leaving it to the states. And it doesn't seem like this is the way our government is operating today, as you read from Mark Levin.
Yeah. So, you know, to sort of summarize or bring it into modern language, what the 10th Amendment means is if the Constitution hasn't specifically assigned a power to the federal government, then the federal government doesn't have that power. That power is reserved to the states and the people. And so let's take a look. We both have our pocket constitutions on the table with us, Dean. Let's take a look first at the powers given to the president under the Constitution. Dean, why don't you kick us off with that?
Well, I will, Rita, but I'm just going to lay out a question that I'm going to throw at you later. Mm-hmm. And that is, if this 10th Amendment is so clear, why aren't we following the 10th Amendment? Are we ignoring it? Have we simply trashed it? I'll get to that.
You'll have to stay on the edge of your seat.
I do.
I'm here. Get there.
But let's be clear about this enumeration of powers and the way that certain powers are allocated to the president, certain powers to Congress, certain powers to the court.
Right.
The president's powers are found in Article 2. Of the Constitution. I'm going to give you a nutshell version of this, but I actually have 9 specific powers that are enumerated for the president himself. And so here are,
do we find anything about bathrooms in here? I can't wait to see.
Let's check. I mean, if he has a telephone and a pen, he can do whatever he wants. What's the constant? It's a little bit like Nancy Pelosi once said when on Obamacare. Where is that found in the Constitution? She said, are you serious?
Yeah. Yep.
That's where we are, but we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yes.
Here are the president's powers in Article 2. Number 1, Commander-in-Chief of the military. Fine, we accept that. Number 2, power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, not just because he's a personal buddy or a strong supporter like Mark Rich, I think it was, got a pardon in the last hours of the Clinton administration. Reprieves and pardons. Number 3, a power to make treaties with the advice and consent of 2/3 of the Senate. It is not an executive power to make a unilateral agreement with Iran or any other country because he doesn't call it a treaty.
Yeah.
I think we have to be very clear on this. He has the power to make treaties, but not just randomly call it something else to avoid getting Senate advice and consent.
That's a recurring theme when it comes to explaining how these abuses of power are justified.
It becomes a semantic issue, doesn't
exactly.
it? We'll just call it something else. Number 4, it's the power to nominate and appoint certain public officials, including ambassadors, Supreme Court justices, again with the advice and consent of the Senate. This is a cooperative effort, not a unilateral authority. Number 5, a power to make recess appointments. There's another semantic thing. Well, you weren't really in recess, or you were in recess and you didn't call it. I mean, it gets confusing. But only when the Senate is in recess does he have this power to make an interim appointment. Has to be renewed at the end of the term. Number 6, he has the power, or she, to advise Congress as to the State of the Union to recommend measures for their consideration. That's the State of the Union address that we hear. Number 7, he or she has the power to convene Congress or to adjourn it for special circumstances. Number 8, the power to receive ambassadors and public officials. And number 9, and this is important as well, near the end of Article 2, it says that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, including the Defense of Marriage Act.
You mean he's not given a power to just decide not to enforce a law passed by Congress?
You know, that is the confusion. He thinks he can write the laws and then enforce whichever ones he doesn't like. What's the point of having
That's
a Congress?
That's not a good system.
We're in trouble.
The founders would not have approved. Okay.
We are in trouble. Now we seem to be enjoying ourselves, but this is serious business.
Yeah.
We are in trouble.
You're right. Okay, so that's Article 2 dealing with the powers of the president. Now let's take a look at the powers of Congress, which are found in Article 1 of the Constitution.
I count 15 of these. I hope everybody's ready to put all these down.
Well, first of all, we have to a note, because this is really important, that right in Article 1, the very beginning, it says, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. Dean, it doesn't say in unelected bureaucrats who are in an administrative agency. It doesn't say that the president can take out his pen and phone and make laws. It says all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress.
But shared by the president. Oh, it doesn't say that?
No, it doesn't say that.
Okay. We just made that up, didn't we? Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to list these out fairly quickly,
right.
But Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, power to pay debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the U.S., and we'll come back to that one, because that's been a tricky one.
A welfare program.
The power to borrow money, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with Indian tribes. Now, it doesn't say that Congress has complete power over all commerce that happens. It's commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with Indian tribes. Mm-hmm. The power to establish uniform rules of naturalization and bankruptcy. The power to coin and regulate money and the standard weights and measures. The power to establish post offices and post roads. Power to regulate patents and copyrights. Power to set up lower federal courts. To define and punish piracy and offenses against the law of nations. The power to declare and regulate war and to raise and support armies and a navy. To regulate the militia, and power to regulate the District of Columbia. And finally, Congress is given the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution its other powers. And that's another one that has frequently been abused. But there it is.
Well, clearly, Rita, we can see in these two articles, Article 1 and Article 2, the President, the Congress, and in Article 3, which we aren't addressing, even the courts, are exercising powers and performing functions that were not given to them under the Constitution. We've already talked about the Department of Education, the case of the transgender bathroom order that we mentioned, also of Obamacare. All three branches exceeded their authority on this one. I'm sure our listeners can think of many more examples, but I thought of three just off the top of my head. The first one is refusing to enforce immigration laws for entire classes of people who had entered the U.S. illegally. A second one, working to overturn the Defense of Marriage Act, which led directly to the Supreme Court decision to, quote, legalize same-sex, quote, marriages. And finally, removing the congressionally mandated work participation requirements for welfare recipients. The president did this unilaterally without the authorization and consent of the Congress. Well, apart from the fact that the federal government isn't supposed to do what it's been doing and also refusing to do what it should be doing, what are some of the practical problems caused by this?
Well, you know, the biggest problem, I think, Dean, is that any time an area of public policy becomes federalized, in other words, any time the federal government in Washington, D.C. takes over an area of public policy that really should be decided at the state level, what happens is it becomes much harder for the average citizen to do anything about it, to bring about any kind of change. We essentially lose our capacity to be a self-governing people. Just think for a minute about the difference between trying to impact a policy that's being considered at the state level, so for us in the General Assembly down in Richmond, versus you or I, Dean, trying to impact something that's happening in Congress in Washington, D.C. I can call or email any member of the General Assembly in Richmond and generally get a quick response, a personal response. I can meet with them pretty much any day that they're in session in Richmond. It's easy for me to go and testify and to have an impact. In D.C., it's a completely different situation. And, you know, we all know about how nasty politics can be in Washington, D.C. We know about the influence of these big lobbying organizations.
Deep pockets.
That's exactly right. Mm.
That really raises the question. We feel impotent in the face of this behemoth or whatever that is in Washington. So the question is, for example, going back to what President Obama said at one time, we can't wait for an increasingly dysfunctional Congress to do its job. Where they won't act, I will. So how do they justify this usurpation of authority not granted to them by the Constitution? Are they ignorant of the Constitution? Are they willfully ignoring it? What's the deal?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because a lot of times we do talk about federal officials ignoring the Constitution,
right.
But it's actually much more nuanced than that. If they were just simply ignoring it, it would be easier to put a stop to it,
right,
by a lawsuit or something like that. What they do is they lawyer around the wording of the Constitution. They recreate the Constitution through interpretive fiat. And if you think about it, that's actually much more damaging, because what happens is they do their creative interpretation. For instance, you had a great example with what they do with treaties.
Right.
The president can just say, oh, this isn't a treaty. It's some other type of...
It's an executive agreement.
Exactly. And then if the courts uphold that action, it becomes a precedent. And so it's much more damaging than just ignoring the Constitution. You know, a couple of provisions that have been used to create huge loopholes in the Constitution are the Commerce Clause, which we talked about, and the General Welfare Clause. The Commerce Clause originally intended, and we know what it meant from history, originally intended to give Congress power to regulate trade that crossed state borders, trade between different states. Now, it's interpreted so broadly that it's interpreted to give Congress power over individual items that may at some point in the future end up crossing a state line. Well, as you know, that encompasses just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Toilets and light bulbs were mentioned earlier. The General Welfare Clause, originally intended to give Congress power to tax and spend in pursuit of its other specifically enumerated powers. Well, now the way it's interpreted is to give Congress the power to tax and spend for really anything that it thinks is a good idea. If it can say, well, this is for the good of the country, it can tax and spend. And that is basically an unlimited power.
Well, it goes back to the preamble of the Constitution, where it says that it refers to ensuring domestic tranquility. That means giving them free cell phones and lots of good welfare, and providing for promoting the general welfare. So people have really, that's a big loophole that they've driven their actions through.
Yeah.
Okay. What can we do about the problems that we've just described?
Well, you know, Dean, lucky for us, the founding fathers anticipated that this kind of situation might arise. I don't think the Constitution's drafters would be surprised at all that the federal government has claimed such incredible power. You know, going back to the quotes you read from them at the beginning, they knew that man inherently wants to acquire more and more power. I think the founding fathers would be surprised that we haven't used the tools that they gave us for curbing the abuse of power. George Mason at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 specifically predicted that one day the federal government would overpower the states and the states would need a recourse. And that is why, Dean, he insisted that a provision be added to Article 5 of the Constitution, providing a way for states to propose constitutional amendments that check and balance the federal government. So under Article 5, there are two ways to amend the Constitution. Either way, the proposals always have to be ratified by 3/4 of the states, which is a great protection against anything that's a bad idea. But when 2/3 of the states apply for a convention to propose amendments on a particular subject, then Congress is required to issue a formal call and then stand back and let the state delegations work out the wording of amendments that will resolve the problems at hand. Proposals then go to the states for ratification. So this is the project that I'm working on, as you know, Dean. It's called, we call it the Convention of States Project. It's under the direction of Michael Ferris, whom many of you know from the homeschooling movement. And
Patrick Henry.
Patrick Henry College. And what we are working on is to trigger a convention to propose amendments that do three things: impose fiscal restraints on D.C., limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, and set term limits for federal officials. If we are able to do that, we can correct the kind of abuse of power by clarifying, no, the General Welfare Clause does not give Congress power to tax and spend for any purpose it wants. Congress may only tax and spend in pursuance of its specifically enumerated powers. We could clarify, no, the Interstate Commerce Clause does not give Congress power over every single item that may eventually enter commerce someday. We can set the record straight and reverse the bad precedents that have opened the floodgates on federal power.
Well, Rita, some people might say Congress can also initiate amendments to the Constitution, can it not? Mm-hmm. And when people raise that, then you have to ask, well, why aren't they doing so? And I just love a quotation that Scott Lingenfelter uses from the House of Delegates. Uh-huh. There ain't no such thing as a self-butcher and hog.
That's exactly right.
They don't want to limit their power to do the things that we have just described. That leaves it, as you said, back to the states and back to the people. So how are we doing with this initiative?
We are doing well. As of a month or so ago, we have passed in 8 states. Now, in order to trigger the convention, we need 34. So we have a ways to go yet, but this effort has only been underway for a few years now, and it has really begun to pick up steam. We passed in the Virginia House of Delegates this session, and it has been carried over to be considered by the Senate for next year. So I'd love to talk more about it, but we are running out of time. So I just want to encourage folks to go to conventionofstates.com, and you'll find all the information you need. You can sign our petition and get connected with your state leaders.
Rita, that was an outstanding program. Thank you so much. But before we close today, can you give us a quick update on where the Convention of States project stands nationally and in Virginia?
Sure. Well, remember, Dean, that what has to happen to trigger the process is that 34 state legislatures have to pass resolutions. By the end of 2016, we had passed resolutions in 8 states, and we passed in the House of Delegates in Virginia, but we haven't yet passed in the Virginia Senate. We are working on that. If you are listening today and would like to join me at the Capitol in Richmond for our rally and lobby day on Thursday, January 26th, go to Convention of States Virginia on Facebook and you'll find all the information there.
Well, Rita, I know it's going to be an outstanding day and I wish you well. And for our listeners, this just concludes our update on the Convention of States initiative that is now being debated in the Virginia General Assembly and, as you indicated, across the country. So if you would like to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, go to our website at valleyfamilyforum.org and click on the link to Crossroads on the home page. Now we want to thank our sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services and Dunway Dentistry, and also to so many of you individually for your prayers, your encouragement, and your generous financial support. If you would like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. So thank you for joining us. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week
at the crossroads where faith and culture meet. Until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.